This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They were still voting by candlelight in Haiti last night, at the end of a day of anger and confusion, long after the polls were supposed to have closed. Haitians determined to cast their ballots scaled walls and broke down doors yesterday morning to confront tardy poll workers. They were still surging to the polls in the evening dark after a day of frustration and tear gas and long walks to vote in a country where electricity is too rare and abject poverty the norm. 2 years after President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was chased out of the country, America's role is under a microscope, and Haiti has been on the brink of collapse. Up next on Point, America's fingerprints and Haiti's vote. Later this hour, we'll hear from Coretta Scott King's memorial service yesterday and the eulogy of former President Bill Clinton, who had his own troubles with Haiti. But first, joining me now from New York is Walt Bogdanich. He is a reporter for the New York Times with co-writer Jenny Nordberg. He's dug deep into the U.S. role in the run-up to the ouster of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004. His big report was headlined, Mixed U.S. Signals Help Tilt Haiti Toward Chaos. Walt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, to read your reporting, there is a kind of deep shadow of American involvement, even over the elections this week, that the American role in Aristide's departure, we're told, has been a very active campaign issue there. What did you find in your in-depth look at this ramp to Aristide's departure?
Well, we looked at what is the cornerstone of President Bush's foreign policy, which is the promotion of democracy around the world. And we wondered how it was playing out in our own backyard in Haiti, when most people have only heard about his efforts in Iraq and elsewhere around the world. So we took a hard look at that policy, and what we found is that before Aristide was forced out by the rebels and with some encouragement by the United States to leave to spare the country more violence, what we found is that there were basically two arms of the U.S. Foreign policy at play in Haiti. One was, of course, through the embassy in Port-au-Prince, and specifically the ambassador, Brian Dean Curran. And the other was a private, nonprofit, pro-democracy group, which was very close to the Bush White House, which had funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development, the State Department, et cetera.
This is the international, name it for us?
The International Republican Institute.
Okay.
And so what you had what we found from talking to people was that they were speaking with two voices. And what you had was both of them were supposedly down there to promote democracy. But what we found is that while the U.S. ambassador, Brian Dean Curran, was trying his best to carry out the policy, which was to support democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, but work with him and try and get him to reform, to reach compromises with his opponents down there. That was the stated foreign policy. That was the official foreign policy. Mm-hmm. But what Mr. Curran told us in his first interview, as did other diplomats speaking for the first time, but specifically Mr. Curran told us that the IRI, or International Republican Institute, this private group funded by the U.S. government, was undercutting him. And while Mr. Curran and the U.S. Embassy was telling both sides, Mr. Aristide and his opponents, now this is before the armed rebellion,
yes,
telling them to negotiate for the good of the country, to reach compromises, because after all, that's what you do in a democracy. What he said was that the U.S.-funded private group was,
yes,
going around telling the opposition to do just the opposite, not to negotiate, to hold firm, to hold out, and that's the way you get rid of Aristide.
And you report the same group holding meetings just across the border in the Dominican Republic. Of the what?
Well, what was happening was they at taxpayer U.S. taxpayer expense, they flew only Mr. Aristide's opponents, political opponents, to Santo Domingo, where they brought in trainers and to teach them how to organize and how to mobilize and how to campaign better and how to communicate better. And they did so, you know, in a country that has historically had very tense relationship with Haiti. It's a place where, actually, at the time they were holding these meetings, rebels were living, people who had tried to, in the past, overthrow Haitian governments.
Even in the same hotel, as you reported.
Yeah, we had two of the rebels when we went down there. We visited the hotel, and we actually interviewed one of the sort of the architects of the rebellion, a gentleman by the name of Paul Arcelin, who told us that he was in the hotel and he had met with the representative of the International Republican Institute. Now, I hasten to point out they dispute some of this. In fact, much of what we reported.
Yes, we've seen that.
We also interviewed the chief rebel, the guy who led the assault basically on Port-au-Prince, a guy by the name of Guy Philippe.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us that he also had meetings with the representative of the International Republican Institute. So this all raises questions in the minds of some of the people we talked to as to what really was the U.S. foreign policy down there. Was it to support democracy, or was it to support democracy only to the point where, you know, if we like who's in office, then we'll support it, but if we don't, well, then we'll just take our ball and bat and go home.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, it's been a bad couple of years since then, but it was no paradise before either under President Aristide. The poverty, the gangs, the violence, there was plenty before. Was the U.S. fed up with that, or were they taking a side? Were they joining? What were the forces at play?
Well, there's no question that President Aristide was a flawed leader. He had no experience in running governments. He's a priest, a former priest. And he had to run his government at a time when the international community had imposed these sanctions. They were denying aid to his government. So it was a rough go under any circumstances. And people we talked to, you know, said that he was a highly flawed leader. In democracy, sometimes that happens.
From your reporting, if it's René Préval, his one-time ally, perhaps now the newly elected, again, president of Haiti, does that look like Aristide's camp back in the saddle? How do you read it?
Well, the way I read it is this is a huge surprise to the ruling elite in Haiti and the business elite in Haiti, who had tried so hard and so successfully to get Aristide out.
Walt Bogdanich, he is a reporter for the New York Times. Walt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm joined now from Washington, D.C. by Bob McGuire. He's director of the Programs in International Affairs at Trinity University, chair of Haiti Advanced Area Studies at the Department of State's Foreign Service Institute. He's fluent in Creole, been in Haiti 100 times or more. Bob McGuire, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
And we're joined from Charlottesville, Virginia, by Robert Fatone. He is professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia, author of Haiti's Predatory Republic, The Unending Transition to Democracy. Professor Fatone, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Robert Fatone, to you first, if I may. You've no doubt been reading closely the reports out of Haiti. What's your first response to how this election has gone? Successful to you?
I think it's been successful in spite of the chaos, and what is really remarkable is the determination of people to go and vote.
Yeah.
The lines were exceedingly long, and people started at 4 o'clock in the morning, walked for 30, 40 kilometers in order to vote.
Mm.
In the first few hours of the elections, it was a complete mess because the polling stations had not opened, people couldn't find those polling stations, and there was some fear that things might fall apart. But fortunately, by midday, things started to work properly, and virtually everyone who wanted to vote did vote. So I think that in spite of the chaos and the disorganized nature of those elections, that it's been a success to the extent that you've had a huge turnout. And one can only expect that once the results are announced, that people will respect them.
Very impressive turnout. And as we heard at the top of the hour in the news, 300 mules plus helicopters now bringing those ballots in for counting. Bob McGuire, step back with us for a second here. The early reports coming out are that René Préval, one-time ally of Aristide, of course, former Haitian president, now back in the swing of things, may very well be the winner here. What were the dynamics going into this election? What were the sort of major powers contesting here? And what does a Préval victory mean, if that's what we've got?
Yeah, it was very interesting. When Aristide was taken out of or left the country, his political opponents won an election very quickly because they believed they were on a roll. And Aristide's political opponents have not really been able to get traction with voters in Haiti, even though they've been trying for 20 years.
Why not?
Well, I think they don't appeal to the aspirations of the typical Haitian person. Most of his opponents are part of what Haitians call the political class. They're based in the city. They prefer to speak French. They really haven't reached out and shown that they have ideas of how to include those Haitian people who have been excluded from the mainstream of the society for a long time. And, of course, when Aristide was around, he represented that inclusion. When the election did not occur quickly, it eventually gave time for the Lavalas supporters, that's Aristide's party, mm-hmm. to rally eventually behind René Préval. So I would say that the high turnout was really the Préval factor in this election. If there wasn't a Préval running, someone who would represent those aspirations of the masses of Haitian people, probably there wouldn't have been the enthusiasm for this election that we saw yesterday. And I would suggest that the authorities running the election were shocked by that turnout. They didn't expect Préval to run, as was stated earlier. And I think a lot of that early chaos we saw yesterday was indicative of the fact that even the international folks did not anticipate this crush onto the polls.
This polling paid for and run at its heart, I guess, by a lot of foreign agencies here. Robert Fatone, what about it? Was the crush of people at the polls Aristide supporters coming back out? Is this a rich-poor divide in Haiti? Was this the poor saying we want an Aristide-style guy, ally, back in power?
Well, I think it's a combination of very different things. I think there is obviously that gap between the wealthy elite and the vast majority of Haitians. And that's one key factor. The other factor is that whatever may have been the shortcomings of Aristide, he still symbolizes in the mind of most Haitians the fellow who ultimately decided to try to integrate into the political system, into, as it were, the moral community of the nation, the vast majority of the poor people. So that has remained a very significant factor. On the other hand, I think that Préval is his own man. I think in the first time around when he was president, he was really a prisoner of what was then called Tabar, which was the residence of Aristide. Aristide was the fellow who was really running the show. But yeah. I think this time is going to be different. I think the very fact that Préval has been running on a different platform than Lavalas is an indication that he wants to have his own type of politics. And I think the conditions have changed. So while Préval did, in fact, receive the vast majority of the Lavalas vote, I think it's more than that. I've heard informally that even in Pétionville, which is really the area where you have the elite, well, Pétionville apparently voted something like 60% for Préval. So it's an indication that he's not just the candidate, as it were, of Cité Soleil and the slums. I think he's perceived by a significant, I mean, I think it's an overwhelming majority of Haitians as the fellow who can, in fact, bridge the gap between very poor and the wealthy minority. And I think that's the perception. I think that's why he's probably going to be elected in the first round.
That sounds hopeful. Bob McGuire, is it possible that after the years of the Duvaliers and this rich-poor divide, the backlash to the Aristide sort of street priest years, is it possible that Haiti is threading the needle here, that in Préval it might have the guy who can pull these together, get away from the whipsaw from one side to the other?
Yeah, I like that image of threading the needle, and I think the hand that's trying to put the thread through is a very shaky one. One hopes that there will be some movement toward a reconciliation among Haitians. It's quite interesting to me that this is a country that has a UN peacekeeping mission in it, but yet peace among Haitians has never really been made. And there continues to be all types of conflict, sometimes low intensity, sometimes high intensity.
I mean, kidnappings like crazy, abject poverty, people living on less than $2 a day. I mean, even the head of the UN mission shot himself a month ago. It just sounds awful.
Yes, and I noticed in a story yesterday in the St. Pete Times that Charles Baker, the industrialist who was favored as a candidate by the wealthy mm-hmm. elite, is cited as saying that Aristide is the brain, Proval is his tool. If he becomes president, chaos will break out. We will defend ourselves.
Hmm. So he's not going for the moderation line there.
No, that is a very dangerous image, and I would agree thoroughly with what Robert Fatone has said, that Proval can very much be his own man. He is not so much a protege of Aristide. They have been separated and separating since Proval was president and Aristide maintained his position as the power behind the throne. And I think one of the reasons why there's been so much enthusiasm over Proval is the fact that despite the impediment of Aristide during his presidential period of 5 years, Proval was successful in reaching out to the disenfranchised Haitian people and trying to do things like agrarian reform, trying to establish pocket parks and improve conditions in poor neighborhoods. And one of the very interesting things he did that caused kind of a shockwave around Haiti was that midway through his term, he opened up Jean-Claude Duvalier's former private beach resort to the people of Haiti.
And why not? Paid for it.
Sure. Well, for the first time in history, people from Port-au-Prince actually had a beach that they could go to that wasn't, you know, was relatively close to the city, because the beaches close to the city are all alienated by private wealthy landowners.
But they're a tiny...
So these are the kind of things that Proval had done, which, you know, people remember that. And they think now, I believe, that given he has his own man, that he can go further.
A symbol there, but a symbol in a sea of poverty. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Carmelis is calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Carmelis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
We're well. What do you think of these elections?
Thank you for your show, and always great show. First of all, I think the Haitian people yesterday, it's a sort of revenge. And I said hi to them, and I really appreciate the great courage that they have to go out and massively vote for René Préval. The battle isn't over yet. What they got to do now is pay attention to the result, because, like people know, there might be a second round, but we don't expect a second round.
That is, if Proval doesn't get more than 50%, it would go to a second round. But you're saying, watch out, it's not all counted yet.
Exactly. Definitely he will win with 50% percent of the vote. Second, I don't want what's so-called, what we call the light-skinned Haitian tight Proval hand like they do like with Aristide. It's like, I think it's time for United States, Canada, French, who say they really want to help the Haitian people, to now help Haiti to build what we call institution, because one of the main problems of Haiti is institution. We don't have institution. They really have to help the new administration, which is going to be President René Préval, to help Préval build institution.
Carmelis, let me ask you. You're saying they've got to build institutions. I think I heard you say that light-skinned Haitians tied Aristide's hands. But you started out by saying that this result, the Préval's victory, if that's what it is revenge. What do you mean by that? Revenge by whom? For what?
It is a revenge, because they thought that the Haitian people, they just going to, you know, say, don't go to poll. But yesterday we showed that Préval was her last card, and we put it on the table. It's clear that, you know, the Haitian people, they see themselves in Préval, not those people who control the Haitian market who don't like the challenge. That's what I like about the Haitian people. When it's the time to, you know, throw the ball, they just do it. They show the whole world now. They saying that we can't live in a society with democracy, which is, democracy is the cornerstone of a society, but they show clear that we have a voice. The voice is René Préval. I just say to all Haitians, now let's just put our hands together and let's work with the guy. Don't say, well, this guy is too close to Aristide.
Let's work with the guy, says Carmelis. And Carmelis, we've got it. We hear it. We thank you very much. Robert Fatone, what about it? Carmelis says, here's revenge, suggesting this is a kind of a triumph for Aristide, even though he's not back in the country. Do you see it that way? Or for the people he attempted to represent?
I'm not sure it's a revenge as such, because I think, as I've said, that Préval is going to distance himself from Aristide. But what I do think has happened is that the groups that supported the ouster of Aristide have failed insofar as they wanted to obviously gain power, and I don't think they will. So to that extent, it's their own failure. And I think their failure really is symptomatic of the fact that they've been unable to really to reach to the vast majority of Haitians. And I don't think it's just a matter either of skin color. I mean, the opposition to Aristide when he fell was way beyond the question of skin. After all, if you look at the armed insurgents who were really the most responsible for his fall, you hardly found in that particular group any light skin. So I think it was much more complicated than that. I think it was more a question of different interests, obviously the light-skinned population, but also of plenty of other Haitians who didn't like Mr. Aristide. And one has to be very clear about
yes.
it. The last year of Aristide was certainly no picnic.
And the the big election in 2000, no one thought was too well done on his watch.
Yeah, it wasn't well done, although I think that even if it had been well done, that he would have won. What was really, the problem with Aristide is that he would have won fair and square, but he wanted to have power and have it completely in his hand. And I think that was one of the reasons of his demise.
Bob McGuire, let me ask you, if I may, do you see this outcome, if it's Préval again, is this a rebuke to American foreign policy, to America's interaction with Haiti? You know, the implication in the Times story, you're quoted there, I wonder what you think of the story, was that the U.S. was effectively trying to broom Aristide out, or at least friendly to those who desired that. So is this a rebuke to the U.S. or not?
Well, I think so. I wouldn't. I also would not characterize this as some kind of revenge, although I think those Haitians who were mightily upset that they elected a leader in 2000 and then he was taken away certainly feel a sense of vindication today that they're back in the hunt, so to speak. But I think that it's incumbent upon the U.S. right now to engage whoever wins in Haiti and to engage positively. One of the things that Walt, I'd like to mention that he didn't mention, was that, you know, when Aristide came into his second term, essentially all the development assistance to his government was cut off.
Because?
And because of the electoral controversy that was mentioned just a moment ago, principally, but also because there were powerful forces who were looking for any excuse to isolate the guy.
Mm.
And without assistance to the state in Haiti, which is a very weak state, some call it a failed state, I mean, it needs assistance to build those institutions, and it needs assistance to deliver service to the Haitian people. And it will be very important now that the Haitian state receive institutional assistance and not be frozen out with all the development assistance going, let's say, to non-governmental organizations and leaving the state bereft of being able to fulfill its responsibility.
So pull in behind this government when it comes in. Frederick's calling from Boston. Hi, Frederick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, I actually wanted to bring up that question of institution because everybody's concerned with who is getting elected in Haiti. I'm not sure Haiti's problem has to do with who is in power, but the interaction between our different institutions, such as the presidency, the legislative, and the judiciary. And I was wondering if you could have some comments on how the international community could try and help us in having viable institutions in the country so that they can interact in such a way that they can actually rebuild the country.
Frederick, let us pick it up. Our time is short before the break, but Robert Fatone, in brief, where can the international community put its shoulder to help this happen? It's not there now. It's almost a failed state, as Bob McGuire says. What's the best investment of international attention and resources?
Well, I think you have to concentrate primarily on the rural areas and try to reestablish some form of institution in terms of security, creating some form of legitimate police that is not corrupt and capable of reestablishing stability in the country.
Philip is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Philip. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm Paul Walter. I'm from Groton, Massachusetts.
Oh, yes. Very good. And what do you think?
Well, I think Haiti need to have a white American in power to control the country.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. This is the only hope Haiti have. The White House, you know, has to take his responsibility, put a white American guy in Haiti.
Philip, the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. That didn't seem to work any magic.
Well, they did a lot for Haiti. All the infrastructure was done by the American people. Now they stopped doing that. This is bad. But the only nation who could take care of Haiti is a white American person in power in Haiti.
Wow. Back to the future. Philip, let us pick it up. Robert Fatone, there's a Haitian in America saying, you know, send down an American governor. What do you make of that?
Well, I certainly don't share his opinion. I think the United States can be helpful, but I doubt that there would be the will on the part of the United States to take Haiti as a protectorate or some associated state. Secondly, if you look at the record of the American occupation, while roads were built and clinics were built, it was certainly not a record that led to any self-sustaining development or political democracy. So I have a very hard time thinking that an American governor, as it were, would necessarily do the trick. I think the problems of Haiti are best solved by Haitians, which obviously, and they need it. It would be silly to not recognize that. They need foreign assistance. But taking over the country, I think, first, it's unrealistic. And secondly, I don't think it would resolve the problems.
But you can hear the kind of desperation for something in that observation. Dickens is calling from Boston. Hi, Dickens. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I hate to bring this back to a theoretical point, but the political science major in me calls out.
Let's hear it.
At the top of the show, you asked whether the U.S. was a friend to Haiti. And it caused me to think about the fact that democracy is a double-edged sword. We as Americans promote democracy throughout the world. At least that's part of our foreign policy. But it seems that whenever a government, and whether it's elected democratically or not, displeases our foreign policy, then steps are taken to depose that government.
Do you blame the U.S., the Bush administration, for Aristide's departure?
Well, I think the evidence points in that direction. So I, even though I personally might not have agreed with all of Aristide's policies, and I don't think that he was the best leader Haiti has ever had, I do think that we need to be true to ourselves when we talk about democracy and how we treat democratically elected governments. And I think this is going to become even more important a point as we face democratic elections in the Middle East.
Yeah, we've seen it. There it is with Hamas. A lot of democracy, kind of people's voice in the streets lately over cartoons, now a vote in Haiti that may or may not be pleasing to the foreign policy gurus of the Bush administration. Dickens, thanks for that. Bob McGuire, how about it? Is the United States or the Bush White House predisposed to appreciate the result of this election? Or is this going to be seen as a setback for the Elliot Abrams and the Otto Reichs?
Yeah, I think that regime is out right now. Elliot Abrams is in, but I think Mr. Reich is out of government, and the Assistant Secretary of State now, a fellow named Tom Shannon, is on record yesterday saying the U.S. will accept the results. I'd just like to go back to a comment you made earlier, Tom, about taking sides. This has been a huge problem. That the international folks and the U.S. have seemingly taken sides in Haiti. I think that this is an absolute disaster for Haiti if the U.S. is going to take sides. The U.S. needs to accept the results, engage the winner. And more than anything else, I think the U.S. needs to kind of support a kind of a peace and reconciliation movement among Haitians. And also that reconciliation has to occur in Washington, too. Haiti has become a very difficult partisan issue in Washington. I know that there are Democrats on the Hill who had been calling for oversight hearings on the International Republican Institute for a couple of years now. They're not getting it. The New York Times article that exposes these kind of rogue elements, maybe that will help to pull it back, you know, and pull those elements back. But we in Washington need to have a kind of a reconciliation so that we can accept Haiti for what it is and try to work with Haitians to move the country forward and stop taking sides.
May I ask you, the implication in Dickens' call is that the United States sided against the bulk of the Haitian people. I have no idea if that's true, but why would the United States not side with the mass of Haitians? It's a small country. Its economy is so small. It's not like it's got oil, that the U.S. needs to be allied with a ruling elite to have access to. Why wouldn't the United States align itself with the Haitian population at large?
Well, in fact, the U.S. did align itself with the Haitian population when Mr. Aristide was restored in 1994. But, there were political changes since then in Washington, and I believe there were voices that came into our government who, you know, viewed Mr. Aristide with a great deal of fear and loathing.
But this isn't Cuba. They're not going to have missile bases there. What would be the problem? What was the critique or the reluctance to? I mean, I know there are all kinds of problems with corruption. They just didn't like the cut of his jib. But materially, what's the problem here?
Well, I think in part it was Mr. Aristide's approach, which was very provocative. I mean, he did had to kind of speak out of both sides of his mouth. In Haiti, he had to speak to his constituency, which was very provocative to the U.S. And on the international plane, he had to try to be a diplomat. And I think, as Walt Bogdanovich said, that Mr. Aristide was really not much of a politician in the end. Mm. So I just think that the U.S. really does need to step back and stop promoting one side or the other. And I would go back to this comment by Mr. Baker, one of the opponents in this election, who is already on record saying that if Preval becomes president, chaos will break out.
Yeah.
And we will defend ourselves. This is a very, very dangerous statement to make. And, of course, it challenges Mr. Preval to address the potential of chaos breaking out, but it also challenges Baker and his allies to say, look, you know, we've got to back away from the traditional Haitian politics that say, if we don't win, we do everything in our power to undermine the winner. Mm-hmm. We've got to say, okay, let's seek some kind of a detente here, and in the interest of the country of Haiti and its citizens, how are we going to move forward together?
Let me get a couple more calls here. Joshua is calling from Boston. Hi, Joshua, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show, as always. I'm a great fan of yours. I think that your guest, Dickens, everybody have touches on some interesting points. The U.S. and the international community have funded Haitian election $60 million.
$30 million from Washington, yeah.
$30 million from Washington and $30 million from the international community.
Yes.
The idea is that if the U.S. is supporting an election, I'm sure that the U.S. does know who's the front runner, who's going to be, and how it is.
Well, maybe not. I mean, Condoleezza Rice said after the Hamas election, we were blindsided, in effect. But what's your point, Josh?
My point is that if, in fact, you ousted Aristide, Haiti is a small country, Tom. As you know, if the U.S. would like to restore basic security in Haiti, the infrastructure is all broken.
So where are you going?
You need to have a government. You need to have someone in power that can actually understand the 21st century thinking.
Can Preval do that, René Preval?
I think these guys are out of ideas. You need some fresh new ideas, someone who can take some bold step, who will be working for the people, not for the elite few.
So there's the longing for a perfect leader. Everybody would like to have one, but few countries get a perfect one. Let me get one more call. Joshua, thanks for your call. Marie is calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Marie?
34 years ago today, I entered the States, and I have yet to naturalize to become an American citizen.
You are still a Haitian.
I'm still a Haitian, hoping every day that things will change in Haiti. And they are not changing. I'm really losing hope.
What about yesterday's election? Even after that,
The outcome of this election will influence my decision as to whether or not I should go ahead and become an American citizen. And
well, if you're going to live here, why not? Why not go back and work on it, or send money back, or support Haiti from afar?
Well, I do support Haiti in my own way. I do. And you know, before I came to the States, I didn't want to come. I wanted to stay in Haiti to help the people.
Yeah.
And my parents forced me to come to the States. And my family thinks I'm rebelling because as of today, I've retained my Haitian citizenship.
Marie, why aren't you more hopeful today? You've got a new election here. The chance at a new start, as bad as things are, and they're bad.
One of your guests made a very good point. Mr. McGuire, he said that Haitians must reconcile among themselves, and that has not happened, and that needs to happen. I don't think we can continue to depend on the international community, particularly on the U.S., to help us out. We have to help ourselves.
So do it at home, and maybe Haitians in America could play an important role in that. Robert Fatone, it is a very tough spot this country's in. Could be a collapsed state, very near to it already. Do you see the chance for a turnaround in this election, or is that too much to hope for?
Well, it's going to be very complicated. On the other hand, I think we are so close to a disaster that it might, in fact, be the incentive to reconcile and to reach some form of compromise and national reconciliation.
Professor Fatone, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Bob McGuire, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
In a moment, Bill Clinton on the life and legacy of Coretta Scott King. This is On Point. Coretta Scott King was laid to rest yesterday. 15,000 people, including four presidents, celebrities, and civil rights leaders, attended the six-hour-long funeral at Atlanta's New Birth Missionary Baptist Church. President George W. Bush was among the first to speak. "We knew Mrs. King in all the seasons of her life," he said, "and there was beauty and dignity in every season." The service also touched the political, with pointed criticism of the Iraq War and domestic surveillance coming from former President Jimmy Carter and the Reverend Joseph Lowry, one of the founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But the church's biggest response came for former President Bill Clinton. In his eulogy, Clinton urged the nation to carry forward the legacy of Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King. Here's an excerpt.
"So what will happen to the legacy of Martin Luther King and Coretta King? What will be the meaning of the King holiday every year? And even more important, Atlanta, what's your responsibility for the future of the King Center? What are you going to do to make sure that this thing goes on? I read in the newspaper coming down here that there's more rich black folks in this county than anyone in America except Montgomery County, Maryland. What are we going to do? This is the first day of the rest of our lives. And we haven't finished our long journey home. The one thing I always admired about Dr. King and about Coretta when I got to know her especially is how they embraced causes that were almost surely lost right alongside causes that they knew if they worked at hard enough, they could actually win. They understood that the difficulty of success does not relieve one of the obligation to try. So all of us have to remember that. What are we going to do with the rest of our lives? You want to treat our friend Coretta like a role model? Then model her behavior. And you know, we're always going to have our political differences. We're always going to have things we can do. And this has been, a brilliantly executed and enormously both moving and entertaining moment. But we're in the house of the Lord. And most of us are too afraid to live the lives we ought to live because we have forgotten the promise that was made to Martin Luther King, to Coretta Scott King, and to all of us. Most beautifully for me stated in Isaiah, "Fear not, I have redeemed thee." I have called thee by thy name. Thou art mine. We don't have to be afraid. We can follow in her steps. We can honor Dr. King's sacrifice. Everybody who believes that the promise of America is for every American, everybody who believes that all people in the world are caught up in what he so eloquently called the inescapable web of mutuality, every one of us, in a way, are all the children of Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King. And I, for one, am grateful for her life. Thank you.
Former President Bill Clinton eulogizing Coretta Scott King yesterday at New Birth Missionary Baptist Church just outside of Atlanta. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.